I think you all now believe that this formula here does indeed generate an orthogonal basis. It's not a normalized basis, so when we construct the Hamiltonian, we should be careful to add those normalizations. And then the Hamiltonian is now tri-diagonal, so it has only diagonal matrix elements and the sub-diagonals, and this is the form. So, and the point here is that normally, even if you only construct, let's say, 50 to 100 states or something like that, for these spin chains, even, you know, quite large ones where the Hilbert space may have millions of states, you only need something like 50 to 100 of these Lanczos vectors, typically, to converge. So the size of these vectors, phi m, they will be, let's say, up to millions of elements, but you only need on the order of 100 of them or so. Okay, so there's some potential problems here. These normalization constants can be very large because, okay, what are we doing? We act with the Hamiltonian many times to get a new state, and then the normalizations are the overlaps of these unnormalized states. So you may get some problems with some huge numbers. It's easy to fix that in various ways, but let me tell you about one way which we will use later as well. So instead of working with this basis of unnormalized states that we did first in our iteration, we can immediately normalize the states. And then the procedure is slightly different. So now, you again start with a random state, normalize it, and then the next state is generated like this as before, but now we put the normalization as well, and now I call it just 1 over n1, like this. And then the following ones are all given by this general formula, same as before, but now the normalization is here in front. So what we do in this case is we first just do the same operation as before, and I call that gamma m, and then we normalize it, meaning that we just compute the overlap of that state with itself, and that gives us this normalization constant. And so the definitions are slightly different here because we have included the normalization here. So now this AM, well, the AM is as before, but this NM is the square root of what we had before. So that's the only difference. And okay, so then there are no B elements. So because now, before we had, what we had here was what we called B something. Now we call that N. So you can easily check that this is really the same thing. It's just reshuffling some of the normalization weights and this way. Okay, so then the matrix elements, if we do it this way, are like this. So again, there's no B's and just N's. Yes, please.
That it might be shifted by one or something.
Let's see.
It's gamma m over n m plus one there.
Well, yeah, because, okay, so I just call this gamma m. I could call it gamma m plus one, but I just call it gamma m because it's something we get based on. So it's just a temporary thing anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
On the left hand side, you have psi m plus one eventually equal to gamma m over m plus one. So there's an index mismatch somewhere between the m's?
No, I think it's correct because this is just. You see, this one doesn't appear anywhere else. Right? It's just a temporary name. I could call it George. Right? It doesn't matter. I will only compute it once and then normalize it, and then it's called like this.
So that NM inside is generated from the gamma M you get later.
Right, right. Inside, that was generated the previous time, actually.
But then your definition down here can't be. Because you need the next term to.
Well, no, I can't say no. Okay, let me say it again. How do you? So, you have phi m and then minus 1, right? Mm-hmm. So you can do this operation in here. Yeah. Then you get a vector, and that vector I call gamma m, right? And now, you just have to normalize that vector, and that the normalization of that vector I call phi m plus 1. And the normalization just involves computing this number, and that's very simple because it's just, you have that thing which we call gamma m. So now you just have to compute this thing, which is completely trivial, right? Mm-hmm. And then to normalize that, then you just divide your gamma m by n, what I call n m plus 1. So your n m plus 1 is the square root of this guy.
Yes.
Okay, so
the blue one should be n m plus
1. Oh, okay, so maybe I have, let's see. Okay, sorry. Oh, okay. You're right, guys. Sorry. That's true because I, yeah. So because of my maybe stupid convention here. Yeah, okay. Good you noticed it. Right. All right. Okay, so I will try to remember to change that before I post the slides. All right, so then we have the Hamiltonian in this form. I hope everybody's happy with that. Now, okay, so how do we do this in practice? So now I will actually work with this way of using the normalized vectors. Typically, if you look at least in the condensed matter literature about exact diagonalization, you will see the Lanczos method for some reason discussed in the way I talked about it before, with these unnormalized vectors. But let's just work with the normalized ones. It doesn't really take any longer, and it's in some sense more convenient. Okay, so we want to generate this basis. So again, the size of these vectors, so this number, this index A here, goes from 1 to m, and this m is what can be really large, and this is the number of Lanczos vectors, and we just discussed how to get them. Okay, now we want to have in mind that we probably also want to implement symmetries of the Hamiltonian. So these are some states in a given sector of quantum numbers, magnetization, momentum, whatever we use. So in principle, to generate all these Lanczos vectors and to get the Hamiltonian, we only need to store two of these vectors. So to get the next one, we just need the previous ones. And then when we do all this, we of course store these elements. Well, we do it in this way now. So we will store these numbers, and that's just a small number of numbers. So in principle, we don't have to store all these vectors. And if you really want to push, you know, within the limits of your computer and so on, you may not be able to even store all these vectors because they may be, let's say, tens of millions of elements each. So then you would actually just keep two of them. But then the problem is when you finally want to compute some expectation values, you diagonalize that tri-diagonal Hamiltonian, which is a simple thing, but then you need to transform these states into the basis where you can actually compute something. So, okay, diagonalizing the Hamiltonian, you get the energies, right? So that's fine. But if you also want some expectation values, you need to transform back to these states. Just the Lanczos vectors, which are of size, let's say 100, don't contain everything you need, so you need to regenerate then all these states. But actually nowadays computer memory is pretty cheap, so you all have a lot of memory in your computer, so unless you really push the limits of what can be done, I would actually recommend to store all the vectors. So it used to be that people did only store two, and then you have to basically repeat the generation of the Lanczos vectors when you want to compute something. But let's just work under the assumption that we can store all of them. And then we can actually also take care of what we will see are some stabilization problems, as was mentioned even yesterday. Eventually, this Lanczos basis will become non-orthogonal because of numerical errors that will accumulate, and that eventually will cause some problems. So sometimes we may have to re-orthogonalize the states explicitly, and then we need to store all of them. So it's very simple to do that. I will show you how. Okay, so the main computational effort in the Lanczos method is in this step. So when you construct the next vector, you have to act with the Hamiltonian on your previous vector. And we will discuss a subroutine which I just call H operation, which takes one vector and gives you the Hamiltonian times that that vector. And we will also have a subroutine that normalizes the state, so give it the state as input, you normalize it, and we also need that normalization constant, that's that number n, n plus 1 there. So that subroutine will also give us just the number before, so the overlap of the state with itself before it was normalized, as I say here, all right? So that's what we have to do. Okay, so let's see how we start. So initially we want to start from a random state, typically. In some cases maybe you want to start from something else, but let's assume we start from a random state. So this is just, again, the name for our random number generator, so you just put some random numbers there. And then we normalize that state. We will not actually, in this case, need this n-naught, but anyway, we get it there. The second state, so now we act on our phi-naught with the Hamiltonian and we get phi-1. And then we have to compute those constants. So what we do, we act with the Hamiltonian and then take the overlap with psi naught. So this will be the matrix element then of H sandwiched between psi naught states. And then the next Lanczos vector is given. This now was when the Hamiltonian had acted, this was the old one. So this is what we get. And then we normalize it and we get that number n1, which we will need in the next step. So this is the generic way for all the rest of the states. Act with the Hamiltonian, we get this state. And now the way I write it is under the assumption that these are stored as some vectors labeled by this this index m. So this is the A constant, and this is the new state. We normalize it, and so on. So that's pretty straightforward. So when we do something like this, of course, we want to know where we should stop. As I mentioned that, okay, maybe typically lambda would be 100 or something like that, maybe even smaller, maybe just 50. But when do we stop? So the Hamiltonian matrix in the Lanczos basis is this pretty small tridiagonal matrix, so it doesn't cost anything to diagonalize that matrix after each step. So you could put here a call to a diagonalization routine, so you just put those elements into a matrix, diagonalize it, and you get, let's say you look at the lowest energy, which would be the ground state. And then you can follow, as you run through this loop, you can follow how the energies converge. So you may not even want to decide lambda when you start. You may just want to have an infinite loop here and just exit when you have satisfied some convergence criterion. That would be probably the best way to do it. So we will see an example of that. Okay, so how about this H operation? How do we actually implement it? So what is that actually doing if we really look at it in detail? So one of these state vectors that we want to act on is an expansion in terms of our original basis. So if we don't use any symmetries at all, these would just be the up and down spin states. If we use, let's say, momentum, they would be momentum states, but again, those momentum states are also just represented by these representative states. So it's basically very similar to what we did before, but formally it's an expansion like that. So when the Hamiltonian acts on this state, if we just put H here, HA, and then we insert a complete set of states that I call B here between, and then just reshuffle a little bit, then this is what we do when the Hamiltonian acts. So now for each A, we have to run through all the, well, so we have to construct these matrix elements here, right? So we have a state A, and then we act with the Hamiltonian, and again, we can do what we did when we constructed the Hamiltonian before, just act with the diagonal part, so that will give the diagonal matrix element, and then all these off-diagonal spin-flipping terms. So it will take on the order of n, where n is the system size, steps to compute all these matrix elements. But now we don't want to store all these matrix elements. That's the whole point, because this is, these matrices would be too big. So we are actually going to do this H operation in one of two different ways. So we could carry it out on the fly, meaning that we don't store anything. We just repeat those operations that we did before to construct the Hamiltonian. We just repeat those every time we want to act with the Hamiltonian. So do all those, so loop through all these A states, and then for each of those, just do the diagonal and off diagonal terms, and just accumulate this new vector in that way. But we can also store H in a compact form, and that will clearly be much faster, because especially if we use a lot of symmetries, the operation of the Hamiltonian to get those matrix elements is quite time consuming. So, and we need to do it many times. So we will store it in a compact form typically. So I will soon mention how to do that. The drawback of that is that, again, that may, even if it's stored in a compact form, that may require more memory than you have if you really want to push the limits of what can be done. But if we don't really do that, we can typically store. And what is the difference between really pushing the limits of what's possible and doing something which you can handle without any problems? It's really not that much, because if you add one more spin, you basically double the size of the Hilbert space, right? So maybe pushing the limit and just doing something relatively simple is a difference of two spins or something like that in your spin chain. So the question is, okay, in principle I can go to 36 spins, but I may be perfectly happy with just 32. So it's normally something like that. So let's just assume that we can store everything. It's normally the case. So how can we store the Hamiltonian in a compact way? So these are the matrix elements we want to store, but we have in principle m squared of them, and m is large. So the way I'm going to do it, I will illustrate here. So we will store it in a one-dimensional vector. Actually, we will need two vectors. So let me try to draw two one-dimensional things here. So we need the actual elements in the Hamiltonian, and I will call those H. And then we will need some indices referring to the locations in the matrix. Oops, it would be maybe helpful if I try to line these up. Okay, so what do we have here? So for a given A, we will have just a small number of matrix elements corresponding to different B. So I will need to know how many, for a given A, how many I have. So let's say for the first element, A equals 1 there, let's say I have 3. So then my E1 equals 3. So it means that those three elements are going to refer to B, H, and A equals 1 here. Okay, so now I need to know which Bs. do we have there for which the matrix element is non-zero, and what are the actual values of the matrix? What are these matrix elements? So the matrix elements are going to be stored here. So B, H, 1, and okay, B, whatever B is. Let's say 5 is the first one, for example. And then if 5 is the first one, then, you know, 5 would be stored here. So there's just the number, and there is what actual element there is. Okay, so we don't know what this is before we start, but we do them one by one and just add more stuff here. And this will also be stored somewhere. So there's also this vector E then, which contains this number. Okay, the next one, maybe there are 4 elements. So E2 equals 4, so that would contain the next batch of elements for A equals 2, and so on. Okay, so pretty straightforward. So that we have to construct them. And how would you construct that? Well, exactly as we constructed the Hamiltonian before. So maybe I can just quickly try to jump back and try to explain. Well, it's quite far. Let's see, maybe when we go to momentum states. So we had the Hamiltonian here. So you see here we looped over A, right? So that's completely compatible with that kind of data structure because, okay, first we do A equals 1, then we do A equals 2. And then we do these things where, okay, the diagonal element, we always have a diagonal element. So there will always be some A here. So the first entry for all those A's could be the diagonal one. And then what would be stored in the first element would be B equals A. And then we find all these other B elements. We flip these spins and so on. We find the location in the matrix. So those B's are what would be added into those elements of the 1D structure B. And then this would be the actual numbers that we store there. So, and again, you could, in principle, when you do the Hamiltonian operation, you could just do this on the fly. Every time you act on the Hamiltonian, you could repeat these steps. And instead of building up the matrix here, you just build up, in this case, what H acting on element on the basis vector A gives. So your state that you act on is a linear superposition of these states. So you have to do them one by one, and it's exactly something of this form. So I hope that's clear, more or less. Okay, let's see what else we have here. If I can get to it. All right, so now we know how to act with the Hamiltonian. And okay, we actually will need another storage too, because we need to know where do we begin. So that could even be calculated on the fly, actually. So when we then use the Hamiltonian, when we act with the Hamiltonian, we are going to do something in this data structure. And it's enough to know these numbers to actually be able to do it. But just formally here, to denote where in that vector all these elements are, I say the elements corresponding to A are between SA plus 1 and SA plus EA. So these EAs are what we actually have to store. But formally, the starting point is the sum of all the previous lengths of those sections of the storage. All right. Okay, we also can take advantage of the fact that the Hamiltonian is symmetric. So we only have to store the elements for B less than or equal to A, so that halves more or less the size of these structures that we have to use. So any time when we construct the Hamiltonian element, if we get some B larger than A, we would not even store that, we just skip that. And then when we actually act with the Hamiltonian, we take into account that for each element B not equal to A, there is an equal one with B larger than A as well. So let's see how if we have that kind of data structure, how would we actually act with the Hamiltonian? And you see now it's very simple. So let's just look at this loop. So now that the state we act on, I should have added it here for clarity, but I mean the state we act on is a linear superposition of these guys, and those expansion coefficients are in this phi. So looping over all the A indices corresponding to the elements of this phi, and now we loop over all those storage containers corresponding to that element, so 1 to EA. And now this I is some running index which is just starting at 1 and then 2, 3, 4. So I just add to it every time, because every time we do something we want to use the next element. Yes, please.
How do you know where the matrix elements are? Like, in the top line you have 5H1.
Right.
So how do you know what's the one, what? How do you know it's, that it's one there?
Okay, so because that's something which is contained in these storage elements E. So E is a smaller vector, 1, 2, 3. So in this case, E1 would be 3. So when I start, I know that I want to start from 1, and I know that the 3 first elements correspond to that element 1. So they will be here 5 and whatever they are. So those are the elements, and those are the locations corresponding to that. So if you look here, maybe it's clear enough after I explain that. So we do it element by element. So we just start at position 1 in those lists. So this is that index I, which is incremented. And for each A, we want to do EA elements. And EA is exactly, I mean, how many correspond to each B. Okay, and this is the actual acting with the Hamiltonian. So we build up the new vector in gamma. So initially I set gamma to 0. And the old vector is in phi. So for that element, the location in the matrix is AB, and A is, you know, what we act on, and B is what we get. So, so that element is what's contained in that second storage vector there. So that to that element, we act HI, which is just that the value of that element times the expansion coefficient corresponding to that state. So is that clear now? And then the second line here is just using the fact that we only stored half of the matrix, and we assume that the matrix is symmetric. So here I consider a real Hamiltonian if it's complex.
I
is just the index which is increasing every time. So it's just we do this element by element. And this is this thing here is that we know that for a given A, this is how many elements in that list correspond. So for example, when E is 2, when we start, I is this one, and then we do 4 times for that. Yeah, so here I assume it's really, if it's a complex matrix, if we have complex states, it would be a Hermitian matrix, then we should use some complex conjugates there, but now I just assume everything is real here. So this is just using the other element. So in that case, we act in the opposite way, if you will. So this is what that is doing now with that kind of storage. So the most complicated thing, of course, is to make this construct the Hamiltonian. But it's really exactly as before when we did full diagonalization. It's just that we don't store the elements in a full matrix. We just store it in that way instead. So it's really not much more difficult. Well, if you work a little bit harder, you can increase the efficiency. Let's not do the details, but I just mentioned to you So you can imagine that in these systems, the actual number of different values of the Hamiltonian matrix elements are not that large. If you don't use any symmetries at all, then okay, the diagonal energy can have several different values, but the off-diagonal elements are all one-half. So instead of storing those one-halves as some double precision floating point numbers, which is normally what we should always use double precision. Instead of doing that, you could just use a mapping from some integers to some to these floating point values. And since the number of different elements is so small, those integers that you use in that mapping could even be one byte integers or something like that. So instead of in this structure here, instead of storing double precision floating point numbers, I would just store some small integers, and they will refer to the actual floating point values, which are stored in some other containers. So that's, but normally you would not need to push it like this. Another thing is that actually, when we use the symmetries, and we construct the Hamiltonian like we did before, it often happens that you do, for many different operations on A, you actually get the same B. So in this, if you store it like this, you could actually have, for a given A, you could have several instances of, let's say, element 5 here. And if you do it in a smart way, when you compute the Hamiltonian, you will check for that. Do I have the same element before? If you have the same element before, then instead of making a new one, you just add the corresponding value to that guy here, so that you only have unique elements. So that cannot happen if you don't use any symmetries. Then when you have a spin state and act with a spin flip operator, you always get a unique state. But remember, when we use symmetries, we operate on the representatives, but the momentum state actually contains all the translations of those representatives. So it can happen that if we act on a particular state, that you get the same, you get some state that is contained in the same set of translated states as you had in some previous step. And actually, that can often shrink the storage by a factor of 3 or 5 or something like that. You actually normally get a lot of copies. All right, so if you shrink the storage, it not only reduces the memory requirements, of course, but this operation will be faster at the same rate, right? Because you have less elements to act with. All right. Okay, now let's see what we do when we have actually made the Hamiltonian. We have done our Lanczos iterations. We got our tridiagonal Lanczos matrix. Now we diagonalize it. We get the eigenvalues, which are our energies. We always also get the eigenvectors, but now the eigenvectors are in the Lanczos basis, and to compute something, we need to go back to the other basis. I want to talk about that. But I should also mention, as we even did when we started talking about this, that let's say you do 100 Lanczos vectors, it doesn't mean that you get 100 states correctly. You maybe get the first few states correctly. So I will show an example momentarily where we see how the states converge, and the ground state converges the fastest, and then the next excited state will converge a little bit slower, and so on. So in principle, you can get a lot of states, but if you use, let's say, lambda equals 100, if the ground state comes out okay, maybe only the first and second excited states, but you cannot expect much more. So if you need 10 states, maybe you have to use lambda equals 1,000 or something like that. It depends a lot on what the actual physics is, how these levels are spaced, and so on. Okay, let's see how we should compute expectation values. So what we have now in when we have diagonalized the Lanczos Hamiltonian is these eigenvectors in the Lanczos basis. So remember again that the number of states of those Lanczos states and hence number of Lanczos eigenvectors is rather small. So lambda is, let's say, 100. But the size of those vectors is huge. So the original state or the ground state, let's say, expressed, or here I say n, so let's say the nth eigenstate. Yeah?
Only some number of low energy states are correct eigenstates of A. Is there a way to determine the systematic error?
Right, I will come to that, yeah. Yeah, that's of course quite important. So, but anyway, so the nth eigenstate in the original basis is given as an expansion of those Lanczos vector elements with those Lanczos vectors. So these are the Lanczos vectors that you originally constructed by iteration. Then we found the eigenvectors. So if you want to go back to that original basis, you have to transform. And this is, of course, how you do that. So how would we do that? So we want to normally construct some expectation value, and normally it would be in the ground state, so this would be the first vector. And by the way, you probably have seen this, if you diagonalize a matrix with some subroutine that you get wherever you get it, almost always it orders the eigenvalues and vectors so that the first eigenvalue is the smallest one. Right? So if we are looking for the ground state, it will be, we should use the Lanczos vector, the first Lanczos vector exactly. So normally this would be the ground state, but in principle it could be any state. Okay, so we want to compute that. So normally the best way is to first just act with that operator on the state. And by the way, almost any operator you could think of will be very similar to the Hamiltonian in the sense that there will be some diagonal part and there will be some spin flipping part. So doing this kind of operation again is very similar to the Hamiltonian. Okay, so now what is this operation? So we take, let's see, now what did I do here? Phi, yeah, so this is our vector that we want to act on for a given n. And in terms of expansion in all its basis state, which are our, let's say, momentum states or whatever, this is what it is. And now we have to act with that operator. And these are the states which are, let's say, easy to act on. For example, our if you don't use any symmetries, it's the up and down spin states. Otherwise, for example, if it's a momentum state, we would act on the representative and deal with it exactly as we did with the Hamiltonian. So formally, again, if we put in a complete set of states, this is what we get. So before we had the Hamiltonian, now we have some other matrix elements. And now we have those expansion coefficients there, which are given by, they contain these Lanczos elements as well. Okay, so, well, this is just shuffling this around a little bit. So this in the end will be just another vector, right? I mean, when I act with the operator, you just get on a vector, you just get a different vector. And then in the end, to see what the matrix element, we just take the scalar product of that vector. So this is all, I mean, I know it probably looks a little bit messy, but in the end, it's just completely standard linear algebra, and the only confusing thing is really that we are dealing with several different bases. So first, when we really start, we just have the spin up and down states, right? So that's a basis. Then we go, for example, to the momentum basis. So these states A could refer to actually momentum states, right? And then we have the Lanczos vectors that we constructed, which are the ones that I call phi m here. And then finally we have the Lanczos eigenvectors, which are these smaller vectors. So there are somehow several different spaces that you have to keep in mind here, and I think that's probably what is the most confusing here. Yes, please.
Momentum basis, each one of those has its own Lanczos expansion, essentially, of states.
Right, so you mean each, for each different momentum.
Yeah.
Right. So normally when you do the Lanczos, you would say, okay,
I want to study momentum zero, parity plus one, spin reflection, symmetry, quantum number minus one, and you would construct those. Right, exactly. And I mean, first, before you use Lanczos, you have to do everything that we did before when we did complete diagonalization. Right? It's only that instead of diagonalizing the whole matrix, you do find the lowest state using the Lanczos method. But everything that we did before with full diagonalization, you do as well. But that all comes in really when you act with the Hamiltonian or let's say when you construct that storage, and also when you act with any other operators, then you of course need to know what are those states. If you don't use any symmetries, those are just the bare spin states, spin up and down states. But if there are momentum states, they are matrix elements in the momentum basis, and you have to deal with everything that we had to deal with when we made the Hamiltonian, but not more than that. It's just exactly like that. So you remember if we have momentum states and we construct the Hamiltonian, also there in the end what we do is we just flip some spins and so on, because we only need to work with the representative state, right? But the matrix element contains some stuff from the fact that they are momentum states. So there are all these, for example, in pure momentum states, there's some exponential of some stuff there, and there is some ratio of normalization constants and so on, right?
So are we guaranteed, like, if we choose different momentum eigenstates, essentially, there's not going to be any mixing of them in any particular states because they're...
Absolutely not, yeah. Because everything is restricted to that block, so it's mathematically impossible that you could, somehow go outside. Yeah.
All right. So I think, if you ever use Lanczos, you should just sit down and look at this carefully again. If you haven't seen it before or anything, I'm sure it seems confusing, but I think you at least get an idea, and if you are actually going to use it, which I think some of you are, then you would, of course, sit down and do the details, and hopefully you could look at these slides and maybe read something. Okay, now let me show you this issue about the convergence and if we can somehow get an idea what the error is. So here I show an example. So this is for a 24-site chain. And again, this is similar to what I just said. Well, zero magnetization block, K equals zero, P equals one, Z equals one. And this turns out to be, in these Heisenberg chains, the sector of the ground state. One can prove some of those things exactly, so this is just to show anyway. So this is the block size, 28,000 something. So in principle, this may be something you could still diagonalize if you really pushed it. Now let's see what we get here in the Lanczos methods. What I plot here is the four lowest eigenvalues that I get from when I have used a Lanczos basis of size lambda, diagonalized that tri-diagonal matrix. And then I also computed the spin, and to compute the spin, I again act with S squared, which is something very similar to the Hamiltonian, a bigger sum, but the kind of operations is very similar. And then I assume that the expectation value of S squared is S times S plus 1, which will be true only if I have a spin eigenstate, a total spin eigenstate. Yeah?
There's no guarantee that the first excited state here is lower than the ground state of a different block, though, correct? of some block which you haven't chosen.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So this is what you will play with in the tutorial today. Actually, maybe not today with the lanterns, but you will look at it with diagonalization, look at some levels. So yeah, definitely the first excited state normally is in some other block, in fact. So for these spin chains, the ground state has momentum zero, but the first excited state actually has momentum pi. So to look at the first excited state...
But it's the ground state of that block,
right? Right, that's right. It's the ground state of that block. Anyway, in this particular block, now you see what happens as a function of the line choice basis size. The ground state energy has converged already, let's say lambda equals 20. And again, what do you mean by converged? Well, you could use some criterion that if the energy changes by less than some epsilon when you go to the next step, then you're fine. And that epsilon, you can even, for that, you could even use the precision of double precision numbers, so something like 10 to the minus 15 or something like that. If you use something, let's say 10 to the minus 20, and you take it as a difference, then it would never converge because the precision of, I mean, in double precision, you can only have 16 significant digits or something like that. So it has to be a little bit above that threshold. But you can really convert it to the full precision of your computer. But now you see that the higher states definitely converge slower. I mean, that's pretty clear from this. But if you need some higher state, you can put the convergence criterion for that state instead of for the ground state. Now, if you look at the spin, which is some property of the state, you see that, okay, so here the spin should be an integer, but here when you start, the states are not yet total spin eigenstates. So when I use that measurement of S squared and then convert it to S times S plus 1, just extract S from S times S plus 1, you get something which is not clearly good. But you see eventually for these states you converge to zero, so the ground state is a singlet, the next state is a triplet, S times, oh let's see, no, it's not, sorry, it's a spin 2, right? Actually, this is also a funny thing. I think I will not discuss it in detail, but I can just mention it, that we use this, in this case, the spin inversion quantum number. So it turns out that those correspond to even and odd total spin as well. So it also depends on the system size, it turns out. But let's see, is it multiple of 4 or something like that? I think so. So if the system size is a multiple of 4, then if z equals 1, you get the even spins. And for z equals minus 1, you get odd spins. That's another thing one can actually prove without too much effort, but let's not do it here. Was there another question? All right. Okay, we talked about the fact that we can have loss of orthogonality. So we have numerical errors for sure, and we do these iterations potentially many times, well, at least tens of times. And it turns out that this is quite sensitive, so you can get some errors from non-orthogonality. And what does that actually do? So imagine what happens. You construct the Lanczos basis. You assume that it's orthogonal. At some point, some of your states will have some component of the ground state. So some of your higher states, how should I say, some of these Lanczos vectors that you construct iteratively, at some point they will have some components of the lower states in them. And what that means is that actually you can start to get several copies of the same state. So you see it here. So here is a case where actually this is even just a smaller chain even. It would happen in this case too if I just go a little bit further. So you see now I have the ground state here and it's pretty much converged. And
the first excited state has pretty much converged. But then what happens is that now these states here, they start to get some component of the ground state in them. And that component will at some point completely take over, because it's like the higher states also start to converge to the lowest state that they have in them, and they should not have any component of the ground state in them, but at some point they will, and that component will just explode. So you get now two copies of the ground state, and you see higher states collapse, as it's called as well, onto these states. So in principle, actually, this is not so much of a problem, because, for example, if you are interested in the ground state, it doesn't really matter that you have many copies of the ground state there. But sometimes it can be a problem. But we can actually quite easily get rid of this problem by reorthogonalizing. So here I show what happens when I reorthogonalized, and I will show you exactly what I did in the next slide. So what we want to do when we construct a new Lanczos vector, we want to make sure that it's really numerically orthogonal to all the previous vectors. So we can just do this. We compute for each. So let's say lambda m is the one we just constructed. And for each I is less than m, we compute one by one these overlaps. And then we take, we subtract that amount of those states from what we had, and this is just renormalizing it. So you can easily see that this state doesn't have any component of phi I in it, and if we do it for all I, then it will actually make sure that everything is orthogonal again. So it's just a very small modification of the Lanczos basis construction. So this is what we had before in black. Now we just include this part. So when we have computed our new state, we just make sure that it's we subtract all those components. So normally these numbers will be really, really small because we do it all the time. So they never have time to become big, but it plays it makes a huge difference. All right, so I think I can still talk about one sort of funny issue about this Lanczos method. So if we have a degenerate multiplet, which of course can often happen, that you have some states that just differ by some symmetry, but they have exactly the same energy. It turns out the Lanczos method cannot give you degenerate states. So let's see why. It's actually easy to see why. So if we go back to how we started, just acting on a state with a high power, and let's see. I'm just thinking why. Oh, okay. So let's assume that there are two degenerate states, that these I and J are degenerate states. So then I just write this as a sum over expansion over eigenstates, but I want to separate out the ones that are degenerate. So I assume that nothing is degenerate in this sum. And for the degenerate states, well, they have the same energy. So that's why I can pull out a common energy in front of them. So these expansion coefficients depend on the initial state I start with, the psi, of course. So now as I go on, you can see that I can never, so as I go to higher powers of lambda, the only thing that changes here is these energies to some power. So you see, I never can get a different mix of these two degenerate states. So whatever I had in the beginning, I will always stay with. So that means I can actually not get more than one state with the same energy. So I could have shown you an example of that, but I don't have an example. So it's just something that you have to keep in mind. So if there are degeneracies like that, it's something that you even know just by symmetry that you should have. Actually, let me just give you an example. Right, within the same sub. So, let's see. Where do that look? So, for example, if you do another problem, this is not even a many body problem, just solve some particle in a box states. Then you know that, okay, the ground state has some shape, but there will be some excitations in the system where the electron density is something like that. And there will actually be also a degenerate one which has the states like that, and those will have the same energy. So unless we separate those in some way by implementing some block diagonalization, they would be degenerate. So I mean, of course, momentum states with plus minus k, if we don't block diagonalize with the momentum, we should get two degenerate states plus minus k. But if we do the block diagonalization, we separate them. But if we didn't, we would not get two different states with two different momentum. We would just get a state which is some linear combination of that plus minus k with that energy. You had a question?
Yeah. Since it depends, the CI and CJ depend on the initial state only,
right.
If you pick a whole bunch of different initial states, would you be able to...
Oh, right, good point. Yes, if you did, I guess you would only have to do it twice, probably, and it would probably...
Well, I'm assuming that there might be other degeneracies.
Right, yeah, exactly. So if you do it enough times, in principle, you should be able to actually... exactly. You should just see that some states come out differently if you do them many times, and then you can just form an orthogonal set of those. Right? Good point. Anything else? So what I want to talk about next, but I think that will be tomorrow. We will start to talk about physics. I will give you several examples of what one can get out of these exact diagonalization methods. And what we'll do in the tutorial today is to look at some exact diagonalization programs that I have on the website. So if you just go to the website, you'll see that there's a link to some diagonalization programs. So then it has some tasks for you what to do with those. So basically, you will run those programs and see that if you don't use the symmetries, you get some spectrum, and then if you do the symmetries, you should be able to identify the same energies and also assign to them quantum numbers, the ones that you have used in the block diagonalization. And the point would be just to make sure that you actually do reproduce all the states in the full Hilbert space when you look at those blocks. So hopefully that will work out well. Okay, so let's continue tomorrow.